Hey, how's things? Welcome to the Football Diary Podcast. It's Mike here with Dave and Miles, both probably with varying degrees of happiness as well after this weekend's football's been and gone for them. We'll be discussing the action in the Premier League, of course, which centres around the top four race once again, especially after Fulham's sensational 3-0 win over Tottenham and Aston Villa's point against West Ham. But the FA Cup is where the magic really happened, isn't it, guys? The quarterfinals didn't disappoint. Two games in particular that were particularly exciting, I would say. Coventry, first of all, through to the semi-finals with their last gasp 3-2 win over Wolves. We'll be discussing that game. But first, centre stage has to be their semi-final opponents, Manchester United. After Erik ten Hag's plucky Reds somehow smash and grabbed a thrilling 4-3 win over Liverpool at Old Trafford. And a win over Liverpool anywhere is always a big cause for celebration, especially our record against them lately, Miles. But how did they navigate this chaotic game? Because there were elements of tactical decisions being made, but overall it was a bit of an end-to-end game, wasn't it? A bit of a free-for-all.
Yeah, it definitely was. And I think that was the tactical approach that both teams were aiming for. They relied on the fact that they would be able to counter, that both teams would leave a lot of space in behind. And I think Liverpool took the approach of, if we do that, we have the quality to beat Manchester United's back line better than theirs will. And actually, that wasn't the case. On the day, United came up maybe more lucky in some instances. Like, if you think about McTominay kind of scrambling one over the line and Anthony's goal kind of rolled past a few players on its way in. So United got the rub of the green, and they only had that because they were willing to press so high and go forward as often as they were, which is a brave decision against the Liverpool team. But I think when you look at both teams having more than 20 attempts on goal, that tells the real story of the game. And it was an exciting watch for a neutral as I can be in that kind of fixture. And I'm sure for you guys, particularly in the manner in which you snatched the win, it must be the best feeling.
Yeah, I think any win against Liverpool at the minute, like I say, we don't ever take for granted. But I think the nature of it, yeah, really made this a lot sweeter. And I'll ask you, Dave, to try and give me as good a summary as you can about how it feels to see United actually pushing for a win. Because it felt like United really did try and win the game for the majority of the final moments of the second half. And of course, extra time, United just didn't stop pushing, did they?
No, and I think that's a big change, I think, for United. I think a lot of people expected them to set up quite strategically and be hard to beat, but actually from the get-go they were the team that were trying to win the game. And if you look at the overall of the game, United probably had the better chances. I mean, we're mentioning about a bit of luck, but actually for Liverpool's two goals, both were on over the course of the deflections. And then if you look at United, some of our best chances, we just didn't put away. Rashford had two or three, you know, very presentable opportunities, particularly that one in the last minute of the 90. McTominay had two probably easy, quite relatively straightforward opportunities as well, which he couldn't put away. I think, how many games recently can you say that United have more attempts on goal than Liverpool? But that was the case in this game.
It's an interesting one to try and analyse, though, isn't it? Even from an impartial point of view, because it became a point where it felt like it was the team that wanted it the most. And I know from a Liverpool point of view, there's probably an element, Miles, of fatigue there. And I think Klopp almost kind of alluded to that in the end, didn't he? The team have just played a lot more football than Manchester United. But the heart from some of those players in Ten Hag's team has got to give fans and him some hope that they can actually do a lot better than they have been, and that this kind of performance is in them.
I think so. But I also think an FA Cup quarterfinal against one of your rivals, yeah, you should be up for that game. And actually, it makes me question why we don't see that side of United more often. But perhaps they are just well suited to play teams like Liverpool in this sort of manner. I'm not sure. We'll see again in the league later on in the season how well they fare. But I think Liverpool playing midweek, obviously their squad is stretched very thin with injuries. I think this was their 18th game of 2024, and we're only halfway through March as well. So it was a good opportunity for United to get something from this game, and they took it. And that in itself is worth celebrating, because not many teams can take opportunities against Liverpool, as we've seen lately. They've still been in great form and getting good results. I think the main thing to celebrate is the maturity of some of the younger players. Now, obviously, you can talk about it's silly for Ahmad to get himself sent off, but you can see that's just raw passion, that he just wants to be doing something in a United shirt. Hoyland came back, and obviously he disrupted a lot of things. Garnacho just ran solidly for 120 minutes. And Kobbie Mainoo, I think we'll talk a bit later, I'm sure, about the England squad, but he has to be under more consideration, doesn't he? Because he showed again in this game, I thought he was so calm and collected and so mature in a big occasion. And we really need something like that for England, and Man United are benefiting from it massively.
Yeah, Kobbie Mainoo is one of those players who looks so at home at this level, doesn't he, for his age? And it is a surprise he's only in the under-21s in some ways, isn't it, Dave? But he seems like the future of Manchester United's midfield, if not England's right now. How does he manage to get a foothold on such a game? Because we played him quite deep in this game, didn't we? But he's got this need and desire to go forward and to play more of a box-to-box role. And some of the ways he got past some of the players and some of the dribbles he went on were nothing like a defensive midfielder at all, were they? How would you sort of pigeonhole Kobbie Mainoo? Can you? Is he someone who you can sort of put in a box, or is he an all-round midfielder, would you say? I think we've lost Dave from what I can tell. So the wonders of technology, eh, Miles? I'll direct that question at you about Kobbie Mainoo, because his versatility is clear. But what kind of midfielder do you think he is? It's hard to pin him down, isn't it, really?
Better midfielder than Jordan Henderson, who's getting picked for the England squad ahead of him. No, in all honesty, the day that the England squad was announced was obviously the same day as the Villa Ajax game, and I was there, and it was incredible. And I don't want to talk too much about Villa right now, because I'm sure we'll get to that. But on Henderson, I watched a midfielder who I understand he has this passion and character and brings something to a squad, but the maturity that Mainoo shows in his performances suggests that he would be able to bring so much more, because Henderson was passing the ball sideways 5 yards and then attempting these audacious long balls over the top, but every single one went out of play. And you just thought, this is what we're going to see in the Euros. Whereas what I'd like to see is a dynamic midfielder who's willing to pick the ball up from deep, try and intercept and read the lines and support his defensive lineup, but also look to carry that ball forward and activate the wide players, basically, and supply the ball into the right dangerous areas. And Mainoo is already making decisions like that, which to me says, if you're looking for leaders in a midfield, well, develop this one rather than relying on someone whose legs are gone. And that's essentially what it seems. I think Mainoo can do whatever job you need him to in that midfield. And he's at the developmental stage of his career still, despite being on the biggest stage. So really, it's down to the coach what kind of midfielder he is, because the talent seems limitless, to be honest.
Yeah, pretty versatile young man. And to be fair, the kind of free rein he's been given by Ten Hag, it's probably out of necessity more than anything, because our midfielders haven't been that great this season. And he's been one of those players that suddenly found himself as being one of our most important, which is mad at his age. But I don't know if there's many more important in the minute than Alejandro Garnacho, who was non-stop in this game. Not just his running, but always looking to make a play, always looking to make a pass, always trying to close down. His all-round game and work rate was unreal, and I'm surprised he didn't pull it with cramp sooner than he actually did, because he just kept going literally till the last kick of the game, didn't he?
Yeah, and that kind of tenacity, we've seen that kind of be beneficial to his game throughout the season, and he's been one of United's standout players, particularly of late. And the fact that he managed to get through all 120 minutes, I think Ten Hag said he'd missed a lot of training this week as well with a knock, and then still managed to play through. And that run and the way that he kind of read the play for the final goal, there was like this mix-up between Elliot and Endo, obviously. Mm. And he's just there. He's ready. And the way he carries the ball, the pass to Ahmad isn't necessarily perfect, because he is a very raw player, but he manages to put him into a good enough position that you are able to get opportunities from it. And that talent and charisma is exactly what Old Trafford needs right now, because in times where you are a bit underwhelmed by the team or kind of the run of form or the success that you're bringing, when you have a player like that that you can be invested in and the fans can really get behind, changes everything, doesn't it? And the Old Trafford crowd just absolutely adore him. You can see it already. And if he can stay there for a long time, you could have a proper club legend or club icon for the next few years. He's definitely already a fan favourite.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that kind of work rate helps, but I just think it's all around skill generally. He's so good with the ball at his feet, and he's, what, 19 years old. So he's definitely the future for Manchester United if we can hold on to him, because our ambitions have got to match his at the end of the day, haven't they?
Yeah.
But let's talk about Liverpool as well, if you can, because I know I'm happy to sit here gloating and say how good we were. we weren't perfect by any means, but we've been saying how much Liverpool have been surpassing expectations, considering, you know, their injuries and limitations of the last few weeks. They've been playing out of their skins, really, with a squad that's really been tested. I think there's been talk of this being a game too far in terms of energy levels and really testing their squad depth. Are you concerned at all that there's going to be some kind of drop-off now in the title race for them? Because it's one trophy out of four they can't win. But obviously the Premier League's the big one for them, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think if anything, this just means there's one less thing for them to be distracted by. And I think you saw that there was a bit of the fatigue and maybe complacency set in. Because I think, what, in the 72nd and 77th minute, they started taking off some of the big hitters. And that obviously determined how the next ended up being 50 minutes of the game went. Just without Salah, Szoboszlai and Robertson, there wasn't quite enough quality on the pitch for them in the end. So that quality is still there, and it's good that that wasn't down to injury. But we've been saying for ages, this squad is being tested to the max, and there was always going to be a time where that kind of came undone. And actually, it only came undone by a last-second winner against a very dynamic and attacking Man United side. So I don't think that there's anything too big to worry about. Klopp will be disappointed, obviously, that his last appearance in the FA Cup was a loss to Man United, but there's plenty to play for this season still. And when you saw them in Europe midweek and how comfortable they look there, I don't doubt that they'll give Atalanta a fantastic tie and probably go further there as well.
Yeah, totally gutted for Liverpool not getting that quadruple. Must be so sad for them. Anyway, swiftly moving
really
on.
It's a quadruple on. As much as Jose Mourinho got a treble at Man United, isn't it? Let's be honest.
I know, it's not the quadruple, is it? That's the thing. But yeah, let's celebrate another FA Cup victory that's really worth mentioning, really, and that's Coventry City. Championship Coventry City just missed out on promotion to the Premier League last year. Had their own changes of personnel and challenges this year. They didn't have a great start to this season, after all. And there's many clubs that would have sacked the manager after the Christmas period, really, the way they were going. They're climbing the league again. They're now in the FA Cup semi-final after beating in-form Wolves of the Premier League. That's crazy, isn't it? Before we sort of talk about the match, let's just shed some light on how big an achievement that is for them to be performing still this well in cup competitions. Mark Robins' record has been brilliant with them, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible. And actually, I think there was a stat a few years going around about Coventry before that their fans were probably like the least happy fans in the country because it'd been so long since they'd had any sort of cup success or even league promotions. They'd really struggled for it. They found themselves down in League Two. They're having these stadium issues where they ended up in Northampton. They ended up in Birmingham for a little while. And it felt like a mess. But quietly, they've gone about building something really strong. And they were one game away from being promoted to the Premier League last year. They're now, I think, they're 4 points off Norwich in sixth with a game in hand. So they could make another charge for the playoffs now. It's perfectly feasible. And they're in an FA Cup semi-final against Man United. It's fantastic. And that all comes from good management, actually, which isn't necessarily something that the Coventry would have expected, because the decisions they've made recently have been really effective. They obviously lost two of their key players in the summer in Gustavo Hamer and Gakarez going over to Sporting Lisbon. And they spent the money, don't get me wrong. I was talking to Dave actually earlier, who did a video for us a while ago. He's a Coventry City fan, a good friend of ours. And he was saying that the expectation is high for Coventry this year because of the amount of money they've spent. But I'm not sure any of them would have expected this. It's a fantastic result. And there's some talented players in that squad that will give United a good game, I think.
Including, obviously, Ellis Sims, who played out his skin in this game and actually does play for Coventry City, despite some other pundits saying that he's on loan, which is a load of rubbish. He had a great game, didn't he? Could have had more, I would say. Probably disappointed that he didn't score more.
Maybe, yeah. But I think at this level, you just got to take this as an incredible game for him. Yeah, he would have loved a match ball, but he's fired his team into a semi-final against Man United. And considering where he was at the end of last season, this has to feel like progress. It feels like a really smart buy from Coventry. It was always going to be hard to replace Gakarez, but Sims had so much potential, showed it at Sunderland last year on loan, and then kind of struggled to find his feet in an Everton side that were really struggling. And now, all of a sudden, he's an FA Cup hero. And he's not the only one. There's some really talented players there. Hadji Wright looks fantastic. I saw Callum O'Hare close up at Villa, and he's been an excellent servant to Coventry as well. There's some really talented players in that team that I would be quite excited to see in the Premier League. And I definitely think United might struggle against some of them.
Well, I think I was going into this quarterfinal almost thinking that with Wolves' form, this would be relatively easy for them. But Coventry made it anything but. I mean, what was it, 24 shots and 12 of them were on target, which is a big statistic against a team like Wolves. You know, they've lost a lot of forward players, not defenders. So it shouldn't have been this one-sided, really, because Coventry sometimes made it look like it was all about them. So the result was definitely justified. It took 100 minutes to finalise the game, which is ridiculous, isn't it, when you think about it? But yeah, I think you're right. I think the semi-final, again, is not a foregone conclusion, especially the way United can be and how unpredictable they are.
Yeah, and we just talked about how United was successful against Liverpool because there was so much space for them to counter into. Well, Coventry aren't going to give them that, are they? That they'll pay enough respect to Premier League opposition to do their due diligence and not open themselves up like that. They probably will sit deeper than we expected Liverpool to. So that kind of plays into their hands. Almost being more defensive against Man United seems like the answer because they will struggle to break them down otherwise. And when they've got players like Callum O'Hare or like Haji Wright, who can unpick that final ball and kind of cause that chaos in the final third, I don't know how much I trust Man United to see that through as easily as they think they will. So, yeah, we could be talking about Coventry in the FA Cup final, which feels mental to say, but an all sky blue final wouldn't suit you very well, would it, mate?
No. That's something that's for another time, that conversation. But yeah, the other side of the cup draw was obviously Manchester City beating Newcastle in what turned out to be a relatively straightforward win for them. But then the other tie was Chelsea beating Leicester, which was a crazy game. I think we'll talk about it quickly, mainly because Leicester actually, once they found their rhythm and got back into the game, which was weird again, put up a good fight. But then Chelsea are sometimes the victims of their own sort of worst enemies, really, aren't they? They set themselves up for situations where they're going to struggle. Missing a penalty, first of all, Raheem Sterling taking the penalty when Cole Palmer was on the pitch. The game could have been decided a lot quicker, but they made hard work of it, didn't they, Chelsea?
Yeah, as they always seem to. And that's without mentioning De Zerzi's own goal as well, which was just comical.
That's mad, isn't it? I mean, how far out was he? Like 20, 30 yards?
Well, my favourite thing about it was watching it back on Match of the Day and hearing Martin Keown watching the footage of Robert Sanchez going up and trying to comfort him afterwards. Robert Sanchez gave him a little kiss on the cheek and he said, I don't think David Seaman would have kissed me if I'd done that.
That made me laugh a lot.
But it screamed of the chaos that Chelsea are, and actually watching the fans boo Raheem Sterling constantly, just, it feels like no matter what Chelsea do this season, they've had a cup final, they're now into the FA Cup semi-final, they're still potentially competing for a European place in the league, but it just feels like they're so unsettled now, the fans. Yeah. If Pochettino's on thin ice, it feels like they didn't approve of most of the decisions he made here. And actually, would they have got through this game if Leicester hadn't gone down to 10 men as well? Because they held on really well, Leicester, even once they had. It was only, obviously, an injury time when Chukwuemeka and Madueke came through and kind of got them through the tie. So I don't really think Chelsea will have much hope for the rest of the tournament, although they've done pretty well against Man City recently.
True. Do you know what? I'd rather face Chelsea in the final if it got to that for United than Man City, because we know what happened last year, don't we?
I wonder why.
Yeah. Should we move on to the Premier League, where it feels like the top four was once again in the conversation for two reasons. First of all, Fulham's sensational win against Tottenham, which really helped out your boys Aston Villa, but they didn't quite take advantage as much as they could with the 1-0 draw against West Ham. So let's talk about Fulham first, beating Spurs. It has to probably be Tottenham's worst game so far, I think, under Ange Postecoglou, from what I could see. Nothing seemed to work for them. They tried to stubbornly stick to the usual system without some key players that just didn't make it work, did it at all? And Fulham, to their credit, took full advantage of that uncertainty, and 3-0 wasn't a flattering scoreline for Fulham by any means.
No, I'll try and focus on Fulham first, because I think they deserve loads of credit, because we've talked a lot this season, actually, and particularly recently, about Fulham's fine form and how it looked like they were really building something, and Marco Silva as a coach has really brought a lot of those players on. And the one that I really noticed was Anthony Robinson. I thought he was fantastic. He looks like a real threat going down that left-hand side, and he has all season. And with that kind of service, Rodrigo Muniz, who we've talked about recently, is now in the form of his life. That's 7 goals in 7, which is fantastic. I think he got 6 in 45 before that. So you can see the impact that Silva is having on a player like that and the trust he puts in him. His comments about him after the match were glowing, and he clearly wants to see him develop further. But let's be honest, Spurs were a bit of a shambles
yeah.
at times, to be honest. And I said last week that despite the result that Villa kind of suffered to them, I was confident that Spurs would throw away a game like this quite soon afterwards, because that inconsistency is there, particularly when the other thing that we noticed was Mickey van der Ven was out and Spurs persisted to try and play that high line without the recovery pace to get behind it. And people like Alex Iwobi just had a field day with that throughout the game because they were willing to break those lines. Spurs need to find that secondary plan. I know Postecoglou has his style and I admire that. I don't think you should always change your system to suit an opponent, but you sometimes need to change the system to suit the players that you have available.
I agree.
And that needs to be his next decision and development, really.
You mentioned Fulham as well and how good they were. Robinson especially, you said, you know, on one side of the pitch, but I thought Castagne was just as good on the other side. There's a few players that I thought are worthy of mention. Them two down the flanks were kind of key for them. But Muniz as well, there's talk of him being obviously a big star for Brazil going forward. There aren't many Brazilian forwards who are tearing the place up at the minute. So he's got a chance there to really cement himself and his reputation, hasn't he? I think he's such fun to watch.
Well, yeah, Richarlison obviously found some pretty good form early in the season before his injury and then came on in this game and missed a chance that you'd say was begging to be put away. And it's the first time Spurs haven't scored in like over a year in the league. Yeah. Whereas at the other end, yeah, you've got someone who is looking very clinical. It looks like he can do it all. And now, to be honest, he probably could have had a hat-trick. He had one where he completely took an air shot and failed to put it in. So you still see that there is development to be done there as with him as a complete forward. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see him getting a call-up at some point soon.
Moving on to your boys Villa then. Obviously, a point is a point. I think in an away game against West Ham, that's never an easy thing. But the way the game played out, are you happy with that point, or do you feel like it's a missed opportunity to kind of really put some distance between yourselves and Spurs?
In hindsight, with the Spurs result, obviously you would have wanted a win to kind of get the gap a bit bigger and make sure it was in Villa's hands, because now Spurs sit 3 points behind us. Their goal difference is one worse. So if they win their game in hand, likelihood is they go into fourth.
So tight, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's really close. It's really, really close. And it would have been nice to take that opportunity. However, West Ham are seventh and they've just come off the back of an excellent result in Europe themselves.
True.
They are a good side. So going away from home and taking a point, you have to appreciate that. I think there were opportunities in the game for both sides to take it. But I think realistically, a point was a pretty fair result for both sides.
You must be pumped to see Zaniolo on the score sheet as well, because he's a player you've been rooting for.
Yeah,
I think it's only his second goal since he's been at Villa.
It is.
And you had high hopes for a lot more, clearly. Just more involvement generally. But I think the last few times I've seen him in Europe as well, he's done really well. You must be pleased with the options available to Villa going forward, especially with, obviously, the injury situation right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually think that Zaniolo is begging for a start. I really think I would have started him in this game, I'll be honest. I really like Rodgers. I think it's a good signing. I think it's smart for the future. But right now, I don't think he's had enough time to settle. And I think Zaniolo is far more effective. And I think we saw that in the second half when he came on. His work rate has been really good. He's tenacious. He's quite physical as well. He's a good presence. I do worry about the amount of bookings he picks up, because he is quite fiery in himself. But I like that. It looks like he's willing to battle for something. I think Emery's talked quite openly about how the situation at the start of the season set him back a little bit. But it's been a long time now. And at the moment, it looks very set that he won't be at Villa next year. But it feels like an asset that we've underused. And I would like to see him get a bit of a run in the team now, because with McGinn suspended for two more games, Ramsey obviously has been picking up injuries as well. That spot, I think he'd occupy it really, really well, because he is willing to drive forward and create a bit of threat of the opposing fullback. And I want to see that more often. I really like that he took his goal, he took the chance well, and he wanted to just keep playing. And he's gone on international duty now. Italy obviously rate him highly, so it'd be interesting to see how he comes back from that camp refreshed and confident, and maybe he can get a league start.
How are you seeing Villa's attacking options now? Because obviously John Duran started this game, Moussa Diaby's been in and out of the team. Do you think there's a settled way that they can play now for the rest of the season and try and shuffle the pack a little bit? What's your preferred sort of options and even a plan B for Villa, would you say, going forward?
I think it's nice that we can talk about what our options are, to be honest, because it's been a while. It felt like it was Ollie Watkins or bust for a really long time. And of course, he's been the standout player this season, along with Leon Bailey, who we've talked about quite a lot. But it's been really nice over the last couple of weeks to see those options kind of come into the forefront. Diaby was excellent against Ajax. Maybe lacked a little bit of end product at times, but managed to take his goal. He's been recalled to the France squad as well, which again will do wonders for his confidence, because that's what it seems like with him. There is no doubt that he is a wonderful footballer with bags of ability. And we've not quite seen the best of him at Villa lately, but it does look like confidence. There's been loads of times where I've been begging for him to shoot or play a ball, and he's kind of waited a little bit too long. And I wonder if getting the goal in Europe, playing well in this game, going over to France again might help build him back up, and we'll see that towards the second half of the season. And someone like Duran coming back as well gives us that secondary option. I think he is the plan B. He started this game, which I was really surprised by, and he struggled to get into it, if we're honest. But when he came on for Watkins in Europe, he was really threatening. He held the ball up really, really well, linked well with the wingers, and provided some good strength in the middle, and took his goal very well. So that's a developing player that if Villa can hold on to in the summer with a lot of interest in him, gives us a really good option that's different to Watkins, but still suits a lot of our players around, because the way he brings Bailey and Diaby in, well, that's fantastic. That's what you need, really.
You're right. Those kind of options are refreshing to talk about, to have at this stage of a season as well. And Tottenham, I don't think, have got that same conversation about their team. Their first 11 is very much a starting 11. And beyond that, it doesn't look quite as deep as Villa right now. Maybe that'll be the difference between the two teams. Who knows?
Well, yeah, they brought Timo Werner in to do that, didn't they? And he came on in this game again and missed an absolute sitter, as Timo Werner will do. And obviously, Richarlison's still coming back from injury. That'll be a big boost for them. But I think the run-in is really interesting. Obviously, Villa going deeper into Europe will play into that. I think they've got harder fixtures, if I'm honest, Villa. And I hope that they can see those over the line. It would have been great to pick up 3 points here, because I think it would have been a bit of a confidence boost as well. And it might have put some fear into Spurs. And we know what happens to Tottenham when they're competing for something and they're a bit scared. They fall apart, don't they? Probably regret saying that later. But the coefficient looks like now it's going to be both of them anyway. But it would be really nice to say we finished fourth, definitely.
Yeah, 100%. Down to the bottom of the table. On Saturday, Forest and Luton played, finished 1-1. At the time, we didn't know the significance of that because we didn't know the situation for Nottingham Forest. We now do. Talk me through their points deduction, what you make of it, because when I first read the article, I was trying to make sense of why their deduction is what it is compared to what Everton's was. And the explanations are not super clear. And I'm really, it feels like they're making up as they're going along, really, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the weirdest part of all of this. Now, first of all, it feels tedious to bring this up every single time, but sympathy to both Everton and Forest fans, because we're still addressing the issues at the bottom of the table whilst completely waiting on, but realistically ignoring all the issues around Manchester City and Chelsea. So, of course, they've moved quickly to give Forest their deduction. And the whole relegation picture is based around these deductions at the moment, with obviously Everton's being issued and then reduced, and now Forest putting them into the bottom three. It's a sour way for the season to go. I'm not saying that I want teams to be able to manipulate the market and to forego any kind of responsibility. We want these clubs to be sustainable. But realistically, it just feels pathetic. And the argument is that Forest deductions should be lower than Everton's because they were more cooperative.
Yeah, because of their early plea and cooperation. And that meant it was reduced to 4. But I think the initial plan was to deduct 8. But before mitigation, that was. And then they docked it to 6 because of, I mean, the difference between the two breaches. I think Forest is higher than Everton's. Is that right?
But yeah, significantly.
Yeah. So that was the initial thinking, but it's being reduced on the fact that they cooperated, which again, like, what does cooperation mean? I mean, Everton fans probably got their own take on it, but I have no idea what this means for the rest of the Premier League. I mean, Leicester will be coming up to the Premier League, you'd think, based on their Championship season. They're going to obviously face something. How much of a can of worms does this open now? It really feels uncertain, doesn't it?
Yeah, Villa posted 120 million worth of losses the other day, so we'll see. But it's frustrating because Everton fans will feel aggrieved by it, because why would you cooperate with something that you don't feel is right?
Yeah, 100%.
It feels ridiculous. So to penalise them for that, for fighting their corner, is almost like, shut up and take your punishment. And I don't like that mentality at all. I think clubs, particularly historic clubs like this, who helped develop the Football League, should have more of a say on how these things are carried out. So, yeah, it does change things for Forest. That being said, Forest fans will be alarmed by the on-the-pitch matters as well, because this was a result at the weekend that really puts them in trouble, because now, with the points, they're now in the bottom three, Luton climbing above them, and it's two drop points. And now we're looking at, what, one win in nine, and all of a sudden this decision to bring in Nuno, is it coming under more question? I don't want to write a manager off after nine games. It feels too soon. And if you're looking to build something, then you need to give that time. But would Forest have won more than one game out of the last nine with Steve Cooper in charge? That I hate to put it down to that, because it is about more than that if you're building for the long-term success of a club. But I still think ultimately the long-term success of the club would have been in better hands under Steve Cooper than Nuno.
I think if you're going to replace a manager that was, you know, by all accounts, hugely popular within the club, you better make sure that his successor does really, really well. And there was a start where Nuno sort of changed the way of playing a little bit. We were talking in this podcast about the way he got the best out of Chris Wood initially when Awoniyi wasn't available. And there was elements of his counter-attacking approach that seemed to work sometimes. But, I mean, Steve Cooper must be sitting there smiling really to himself in some ways, because, yeah, I think you're right. I think he made a team of players that were basically strangers last season escape relegation against all the odds. What's to say he couldn't have done that this time around as well? I think I'd be good to.
I think he definitely would have.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, he would have kept them up. I'm quite confident of that. I'm less confident that Nuno will, sadly. And we'll see. Apparently Forest are considering appealing the deduction, and if that was successful or even reduced, that takes them back out of the relegation zone again. But it seems unlikely that it would be successful when it's only 4 points, because there's not much less than that they could do realistically.
Yeah.
So they've got to put it down to matters on the pitch. And then this deduction doesn't put them out of it by any means. They're only a point behind Luton. Without this deduction, they were a point behind Brentford. So there's plenty of teams still around that area. I'd like to say, I really don't want to see Forest go down, because I do think there is something to be said of the talent in that squad.
Yeah.
The fan base is fantastic and has been a breath of fresh air to the Premier League. So it would be nice to see them sustain some success there. But there's just so many weird decisions that take place at that club that you just feel like they are slowly killing themselves.
Yeah, not doing themselves any favours despite what's going on with the uncertainty over points deductions. But one thing that is certain, and we'll wrap up the pod with this, is that Jordan Henderson will keep featuring in England squads going forward. let's talk on England quickly, because, I mean, that's what next week's pod will probably all be about. The squad's obviously been announced. There's some beautiful new kits have been announced today as well, which I think we'll all be getting.
Love them.
But what are your thoughts on the England squad, mate?
Ezri Konsa's in there, which is excellent. Well-deserved. Ollie Watkins is in there, of course. But the midfield looks incredibly light, as we talked about. And obviously earlier when we were talking about Kobbie Mainoo, I mentioned that I've watched Henderson play recently and I'm terrified to see him in an England shirt. The fact that he continues to be selected when there are clearly other options. We talked about Ruben Loftus-Cheek is in great form for AC Milan. He could get a call up. And then there was this talk this week about Calvin Phillips having the option to go to Juventus and Southgate encouraging him to go to West Ham instead to play in a better league. But going to West Ham being better than Juventus. Yeah, Jordan Henderson at Ajax and previously at Al Etifak, that's enough to keep him in the squad.
Yeah.
It's a very odd logic. Even like Ward-Prowse, he didn't start against Villa, but he came on and obviously it brings so much in terms of their balls, better option in midfield. There are so many players that you could look at that would bring something to the table. And for two friendlies before a tournament, it feels a bit criminal to have selected him again, but it feels like he's nailed his flag and he has to keep to it. So I don't know.
I've heard talk about
that bit's exhausting, but I'll enjoy the fixtures anyway.
I heard talk about him being included as some kind of like hype man for his professionalism or for his dedication to training and stuff like that. I mean, these are international footballers. I have no idea why you'd have that logic. And obviously that's not straight from Southgate's mouth, but why is he in the squad if not for form? You know, it has to be for form or nothing.
Yeah, if it is to kind of keep the good feeling around the camp, the problem is most fans in the country have turned against it.
Yeah, yeah.
So you alienate the fans by selecting him as well. So it's a weird balance. I think I think Southgate quietly thinks this will be his last tournament. So we'll do everything he can to keep it his kind of way.
Yeah.
And I think he thinks his best chance of winning it is to stick to a formula that's been fairly successful for him so far. The problem is, if you are relying on players whose legs are gone and not playing at the top level anymore, then that's not great. I think Ajax have won 1 in 8 on, with Jordan Henderson in the team as their captain. So it's not like he's in inspired form even there. And that level is nowhere near the international level. He looked so awful against Villa, like so average. And if that's the level that you can't compete at, then why are we looking at internationals? But rather than just focusing on him, I think it's worth looking at the squad as a whole. And there is some exciting call-ups in there, obviously. True. There's a few players that I think are missing, but the attacking talent in that squad is phenomenal, isn't it? And there's some players to really be excited by.
It's exciting to see how Southgate will shuffle the pack, what midfield he will settle on, how many in midfield, what forwards he'll have, because the options are pretty good. The depth is pretty good. And you just want to see England playing the kind of attacking football that you think a team like this should play. And that's our hope, I think, next time we talk on the pod next week, eh?
Worth talking about Ben White quickly with the England squad.
That's an odd one.
What'd you make of that?
That's an odd one. I think he's been slammed from all quarters for just making it clear he doesn't want to be picked for selection right now. And I think anyone who sees an England call-up as a great privilege, which it is, can't fathom why you'd do that. I don't know what to make of Ben White, to be honest, because on form, I think Gareth Southgate even said he deserves to be there, and he does.
Yeah.
So what's going on?
A horrible arrogance, it feels like. I don't know. Obviously, there was an issue where he was withdrawn from a squad before, and we never really found out exactly what that was all about. I don't like Ben White's demeanour at all. Like, some people find it quite endearing when he's asked about football and he gives these really blunt answers and talks about how he doesn't watch other games because he doesn't like football, and it makes him a bit of a comedy character. I find it distasteful and embarrassing, to be honest.
I agree.
And then to pull out of a camp, look, there could be a lot of personal reasons to it, so I don't want to jump down the guy's throat and judge him, because we talked openly about how players should look after their welfare massively, and if there is a reason that he doesn't feel it's the right decision for him, I can respect that. However, when it comes off the back of some quite odd displays previously, it does make me question almost the integrity of the player, which is a shame, because that's not what you want to do around this camp.
I mean, I think that kind of public statement as well, which, you know, we made a statement of it, is always going to raise eyebrows and raise more questions, really. So unless he had something to say that almost justified him doing this and sort of making himself unavailable, I don't think he should have said anything and just sort of almost played it as if he wasn't being picked. You know, it would have been better for all parties and no questions being asked. But hey, we'll see how it pans out anyway.
Too exciting for Enlis.
Yeah, can't wait to see how that pans out. And if it does end up being an exciting couple of games, then you can imagine the media just going crazy for an England Euros win on the back of that, can't you? So the way it always is in this country.
One thing I'm desperate to see at some point is Watkins and Kane on the pitch at the same time.
That'd be interesting.
It won't happen.
Yeah.
But I think it'll be so good to see. And also, I would love to see England play Brazil with Douglas Luiz playing for Brazil and Watkins and Conte playing for England. Personally, that's amazing.
Dream scenario for Miles. Anyway, that's all we've got time for on this week's pod. Hopefully, by the wonders of technology, we'll have Dave back next week. We'll see. But I don't know where he went. I hope he's okay wherever he is. But thanks for your time, mate. And I'll speak to you soon, yeah?
Cheers, bud.
See you soon.